Thanks for coming along tonight to hear Professor Walter Russell Mead, who is in Australia as a guest of the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council. And we're grateful to the Council for giving us the opportunity to have Professor Mead here tonight. Now, he's well known to many of us, but I'll introduce him briefly. He's a professor at Bard College in upstate New York, a distinguished fellow at the Hudson Institute in New York, the Global View columnist, weekly columnist for the Wall Street Journal, author of a number of books, including Ark of the Covenant, the United States, Israel, and the State of the Jewish People.
Is that right?
The Fate of the Jewish People. Can't read my own writing. And Special Providence, American Foreign Policy, and How It Changed the World. And our speaker's topic tonight is U.S. Foreign Policy in the Biden Era. Professor Mead, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the invitation and the introduction. One of the very few pleasures that you get as a public speaker is you get to listen to people say very nice things about you when you get introduced. Unfortunately, you often don't hear quite such nice things after the meeting, but all right, we'll try. The subject of American foreign policy under the Biden administration is a complicated one. I'll try to speak clearly about it. But we have a problem which has much to do with American foreign policy in general and isn't specific to the Biden administration. And that is that almost always American foreign policy looks like it's a terrible mess. If you go back in history to the George Washington administration, the country almost broke up over foreign policy battles. Sophisticated observers of the American system, friendly and unfriendly, have generally agreed on one thing, which the Americans are terrible at foreign policy. Alexis de Tocqueville said that success in foreign policy requires all of the qualities which a democratic republic like the United States lacks, and none of the qualities which it actually possesses. So that's what a friend said. You can imagine what we've heard from others, and certainly all my life, I'm 70 years old. All my life, the United States has been in decline, and our foreign policy has been a disaster. That is, when I was a very young child, I can dimly remember the Sputnik satellite of the Soviet Union. The Soviets had won the space race. American children were not learning math in schools. The future was over. America had fallen from the post-World War II era into irredeemable decline. Just a few years later, we had the missile gap, when again, the Russians were going to defeat us in the Cold War. Following that, we had the balance of payments deficit, the collapse of Bretton Woods that would destroy America's economic leadership and the role of the dollar forever. Then we had the civil rights movement, which tore the country apart and polarized us and destroyed American peace. I can remember when tanks were sent into the city of Detroit, 100 people killed in race riots. Obviously, America was over. And if that wasn't enough, then we had the Vietnam War, which ripped our society apart, which was a colossal failure, lost America the goodwill of the entire world. It was a complete and utter disaster and failure. And we survived that only to stagger into Watergate. When our institutions collapsed, we lost faith in the presidency forever. Ethics had vanished and departed from the United States. Almost immediately following that, we had stagflation with the Arab oil embargo, prices quadrupling. The automobile age and the American oil empire had been destroyed. And I'm even leaving out the predictions of the collapse of capitalism from our Marxist friends who've been speaking about late capitalism since I was a very young boy. But in any case, late capitalism in the United States somehow continued to stagger on. But then the Germans and the Japanese had actually won the Cold War. The European Union would be the superpower of the future. America lacked what it took. Japan's dynamic economy with its clever state-guided system of development had left those pathetic Americans coughing in the dust. Then came the Iraq War, and again, American credibility utterly destroyed. The American position in the Middle East would never recover. The American people had lost their unity forever. And I haven't even gotten to Donald Trump yet. All right, so it has been one long story of staggering decline and failure. And yet somehow we're still sort of maybe uneasily, but we're still here. And we're still declining, and we're still falling. So I am not a person who is at this. I used to be a sucker for these stories of decline and fall and the end of the American system. But I have to say, after 70 years, I've grown just a little skeptical. And when somebody comes in and tells me American foreign policy is a total wreck and the American Republic is falling apart, I want them to explain why so many people in the past have come up with the exact same diagnosis and why they've all been wrong, and then explain to me why their approach is fundamentally different from all of these others. So far, I have not been fortunate enough to hear somebody who's able to answer those questions. So I remain unconvinced. You know, we will continue to decline but not fall. I actually wrote a book about about American foreign policy working better than people think. Bismarck, at one point in his career, was marveling over the United States succeeding again when it really shouldn't have failed. It might have been after the Russians sold us Alaska, I'm not sure. But in any case, Bismarck came up with the phrase, God must have a special providence for drunks, fools, and the United States of America. And that's where I got the title for my book, Special Providence, American Foreign Policy and How It Changed the World. Because if the one thing that everybody has agreed on for 200 years is that Americans are really terrible at foreign policy, and American foreign policy is in a state of disarray, the other thing that everybody agrees on, looking back over the course of history, is that for the past 200 years, the most pronounced trend in international, pronounced and prolonged trend in international relations has been the rise of the United States in power and influence in the international system. So somehow a country that is always falling apart, exhibiting the most insane incompetence at every moment, electing utterly unqualified people to office, with a public opinion that is profoundly ignorant of international relations, nevertheless, over the last 200 years, has gradually risen to a place in the international system that no other country has ever occupied in this way. So, in short, my prediction for the future is the most likely thing we'll see is more of the same. We will continue to fail and look stupid and be mocked by everyone, including ourselves. And yet, then people will sort of look around and notice as our somewhat insecure and nervous national anthem, you know, which is a question. Is the flag still flying? You know, by the dawn's early light, is our flag still there? It will be, as it has been since the 19th century, I think. So, with that as context, let's look at the failures of the Biden administration and the problems of American division and polarization that we see together. And I will say that the Biden administration's foreign policy is in trouble. In some ways, the mental map that the policymakers in Washington are using to understand the world doesn't fit the actual world. And that the world situation has become a good deal grimmer, a good deal faster than many people in Washington yet understand. So what do I mean by all this? First of all, if you look at what people like Secretary Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan were saying before the election and how they saw American foreign policy unfolding, they believed that in terms of geopolitics, what we could do would be, as Jake would put it, park Russia. That is, we'll just reach some sort of accommodation with Putin so he'll stop being a problem so that we can go on and engage in other things. That the JCPOA will, of course, once we return, announce our intention to return to the JCPOA, the Iranians will jump at the chance to get back in. And that will stabilize the Middle East. So America can do much less in Europe with a parked Russia, much less in the Middle East with, in essence, a parked Iran, and we can focus on China without raising the defense budget to any meaningful degree or encountering any serious risks, that because we'll be able to concentrate. What happened was that Russia and Iran decided not to go along with that strategy. As people say in the military, the enemy gets a vote. And Russia and Iran both see themselves, as does China, as in an adversarial relationship with the United States. And regardless of the policy that a particular American administration chooses to adopt at a particular moment, they see the Americans as systemic rivals, and that the American system of liberal commerce and liberal governance is an existential threat both to the continuation of their current regimes and even to their international standing. Here, I think, we've been slow to see this in the West. And part of it is we read the history of the end of the Cold War rather differently from the way people read it in Russia, Iran, and China today. Our reading is that the wise Mikhail Gorbachev reached out to Reagan and Bush, the terrible Cold War ended, and Russia had a chance, which unfortunately it fumbled, for freedom and peace, but many other countries have benefited. And what a great thing it is. And isn't liberalization wonderful? And certainly, if the Chinese and the Iranians understood their true interests, they would embrace such a benign process. But in Beijing and in Tehran, and increasing and under Putin more and more in Moscow, people see this very differently, that the Soviet Union let the nose of the camel into the tents. A little bit of liberalization in the early Gorbachev years. And it set off an irresistible dynamic of destruction and disaggregation that broke the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the structures of the Soviet Union, ultimately the state and the economy of the Soviet Union, impoverished the Russian people, weakened Russia, and which Russia still a generation later is struggling to somehow recover from. This is how Putin sees the world. It's how the Chinese communists see what happened in Russia. And if you ask, why is the Chinese Communist Party absolutely set its face against liberalization? This is why. They believe that liberalization would mean the destruction of the Chinese Communist Party and quite likely the collapse of the Chinese state and the Chinese economy. And they would see that the West in such a case would move ruthlessly to take advantage of whatever economic and political gains it could accomplish. They are resolute in their determination not to let this happen. In Iran, even more so. See, we often forget that the nation of Iran is not an ethnic nation state, but that ethnic Persians are at most a small majority of the total people who live in the Islamic Republic. You have Azeris, you have Kurds, you have Balochs, you have Arabs, and to a greater or lesser degree, there's a kind of lack of cohesion, at least among some of these groups and the central government. What you have in Iran is what you had in the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. You have an ideology that links the country at least nominally together, And then you have a security service that enforces that ideology and serves a central state. And the fear is that that haunts the Ayatollahs and their hangers-on is that if you give up that ideology and with it its sense of endangerment by the Americans and threat, if you start to liberalize, you lose the legitimacy not only of the government of the Ayatollahs and the religious dictatorship in Iran, you lose the legitimacy of Iran. And that the Arabs in the oil-rich province where the Arabs live, who don't always like having the revenue of the oil creamed off to be redistributed in Tehran, might want to join with the Shia Arabs in Iraq or set up their own wealthy Gulf Arab Shia state. That the Kurds of Iran are as interested in independence as Kurds are in other parts of the Middle East. That the Azeris, who the government of Azerbaijan very much, Azerbaijan sort of thinks of northeastern Iran as southern Azerbaijan, as parts of greater Azerbaijan that only wait to be reunited with the motherland, and may or may not describe public opinion among Azeri Iranians, but that hope has been strong enough, among other things, to build a very deep relationship between the government of Azerbaijan and the government of Israel, which share many concerns and views about Iran. So Iran and China and Russia see themselves engaged in a common ideological and geopolitical struggle against an enemy whose mere existence is a threat to their power, their unity, their way of life, their prestige. Now, are they right? A Russian once said, "We finally understand you Americans and democracy." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're alcoholics." What do you mean? He said, "Well, you swear you'll never have another drink. After the bender you went on in the Middle East, you'll never do it again. But then you see a revolution in Libya and you just have to take another drink." And he says, you know, so that you tell yourselves, "Oh, we're realists now. We're over our democratization mania. But let something break out somewhere and you will hit the sauce again." So we don't trust you when you say, "Oh, we're prepared to have a perfectly realist, you know, live and let live relationship with you." We know that if there were democracy riots in Moscow or the government were threatening, you would do everything that you could think of to try to get rid of the Putin government. Are they right? Are they wrong? You can't say it's unreasonable. So in any case, the world is far more deeply divided with enemies who are more determined than American foreign policy has really, I think, yet fully reckoned with. We're seeing, you know, as I speak, the president of Iran is visiting China. You would think with all of those riots going on, he would have more important stuff to do than visit China. But we look at the Iranian plans to build a drone factory in Russia, the closer cooperation that's happening there. We look at how China, despite its denials, has been providing Putin with a great deal of aid. And in spite of all the hopeful declarations that come out of the West, China remains as close to Putin today as it was at the beginning of the war. And it is, I think, because they are rationally calculating their interests. We still in Washington are hoping that these are somehow separate, completely separate things, and that we don't have to think about one big struggle around the world, and we don't have to add up the strength of China, of Russia, and Iran when we think about what are the dangers that we face, what kind of defense systems do we need. We would still like to be able, we're still in that post-Cold War mood of wanting to cut back our commitments internationally. So that's one problem that we have, that the Biden administration has. I think it's learning, but it's learning slowly and in the most expensive possible way through bad experience. Beyond that, I'm afraid that the Biden administration also has a hasn't yet grasped how difficult its core problem is. The folks in the Biden administration, and by the way, I should say I voted for Joe Biden, and I don't know, it's an irrational prejudice maybe. I don't vote for people whose surnames start with T at the presidential level. Unaccountable, makes no sense, but there it is. So, they think that what happened, that we had a perfectly good foreign policy up until 2016. We were building a world order. We were establishing peace. We were, you know, and other countries liked what we were doing. And then the horrible Trump meteor came in from outer space, caused a tremendous explosion, and the task of the Biden administration is one of restoration. And you'll hear this. And if we can just go back to the foreign policies of essentially the Obama years, then we will gradually see the world regain its love and trust in the United States. We will see American society begin to heal, and we will move back to that, to a more peaceful era. I'm afraid it's not that simple. That in fact, American foreign policy had been on a, in some ways, since the end of the Cold War, when I think we read the lessons of Gorbachev one way, and China, Russia, and Iran read them another, we have been on a bit of a false course internationally. You want to be very depressed, and who doesn't really when it comes to geopolitics? You could argue that our strategy in Iran is a kind of an encapsulation of our global strategy. That is to say, look at what for the last 20 years we've been in Iran, Afghanistan. Look at what we've been doing in Afghanistan. We've been building up Afghan civil society. We've been engaging in programs of rural development, you know, to give people an alternative to opium to make a living. We've built up education for women and girls. We've started new universities. We've encouraged the rise of newspapers, and we've worked on the development of civil society and NGOs, all of these wonderful things at the U.S. Embassy. We even flew pride flags from our embassy the summer before, well, the evacuation. All right. And so we had this fabulous policy for uplifting and helping the people of Afghanistan, who God knows could use a helping hand. But there was just one little tiny nagging detail that got left out, which is to say a plan for winning the war. All right. And in the same way, you could say that Western strategy since 1990 has had wonderful plans for making this a better world, for improving civil society, raising the status of women and other and minority groups, encouraging agricultural development, making the world a greener place. Fabulous ideas, benevolent ideas, far-reaching ideas, but again, one little tiny thing we neglected: the balance of power. All right? And, you know, and really such a small thing, while these other things are so great and so alluring and so attractive, and so many people want to go make careers in teaching people around the world the best way to live and so on. And so it's a lovely life, right? But we did not attend to this basic fact. And so we sat for 12 years while China went from a position of such weakness around the Taiwan Straits that there was no chance that China could land a single boat on Taiwan, to the present situation where it's not entirely clear what would happen if China launched an attack. Now, I will tell you that on the day of the last judgment, Neville Chamberlain will rise up and condemn our generation as a bunch of passive, soft-minded appeasers who failed to take note of the obvious facts before them. The Chinese buildup was not a secret. We all knew it was happening, nor were their intentions. I'll tell you, people say, well, later after the war, everyone should have read Mein Kampf. Hitler said what he was going to do. The people's daily news every day has said what China wants to do. All right? But we sat there planning new programs for, you know, uplifting rural women in Central Africa, because after all, Africa is the continent of the future, and so on and so on. Again, I'm not trying to denigrate anything or anybody, and I would love to see women and everybody else in Africa live better lives, and I hope they do. But we sat there paralyzed while China slowly and steadily changed the military balance on the Taiwan Straits. All right. So a return to a policy of I would say criminal incompetence, and not by one or two people, but the foreign policy establishment of the United States, the foreign policy establishment of Japan, the foreign policy establishment of Australia. We were all in this together. We colluded in our group ignorance and our group denial of the plainest duties. And now we're asking ourselves, if we keep supplying Ukraine with missiles and ammunition, does that mean we won't have any if China attacks Taiwan? And discovering quite possibly the answer is yes. And American military leaders are saying, well, it could come in 2023. By 2027, there's a real crisis, etc. And also we're looking at, well, how long does it take to have enough weapons so that we could help Ukraine and help Taiwan? Well, it might take several years. And some of the components might be sourced in China. All right? Massive incompetence. Right? Nobody has been this stupid on this scale for this long. And I'm afraid that many of the errors, you know, that they're not just individual errors of, you know, we didn't read this piece of data correctly or draw the correct inference here. There's a culture in the way that our leading intellectuals and security establishments and politicians and professors are, you know, it's off. We have a map of the world in our heads that does not actually correspond to the world in front of our noses. And as a result, we just have wandered and strayed like lost sheep. So, again, I'm really glad now that I preface this with the observation that American foreign policy has always been a mess. Certainly in the 1930s, we were about this inconsequential in the run-up to World War II. In fact, nothing reminds me more of our policy toward Putin since the Crimean invasion of 2014 than our policy about Japan in the 1930s, which was, we will not recognize Japan's conquests in China. There. Take that, you evildoers. Be shamed. Be shamed. And wow. You know, the impact was tremendous, right? So we have confronted a real geopolitical threat in an inconsequential way. So what will happen now? I think the Biden administration is waking up. American public opinion is waking up. These crazy balloon stories for the last few days have been a wake-up call to a lot of people. I got texts from family members, watch out, that balloon is coming over to you. You know, people were following this story. I've certainly noticed in Australia on this visit a much more active engagement and serious concern about the state of things around Taiwan and the balance between China and the United States. I was in Japan in the fall. It's like a revolution in Japan in terms of their thinking. And as we know, they've announced they intend to double defense spending. I see the Indonesians were in Canberra this week talking about a military treaty, a legally binding security treaty with Australia. Things are happening. And hopefully enough things will happen quickly enough that we'll be ready. But I don't want to close without hitting this point, this fundamental point, one last time. We are looking at a generational failure of Western strategy, a generational failure of an establishment, a generational failure of the journalistic class, of the political class. I can't exempt myself from this. And there's no way we can go back and change that, the past. All we can do is try to absorb the lesson and move on as quickly, as thoroughly, as seriously, and as constructively as possible. So thank you very much. I'm okay.
So many thanks to our speaker. Thanks also to the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for making this function possible tonight. And so we come to questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, a lot of people on Zoom. So we keep your comments or your questions short. And I'll try for starters. If you just come back here. You mentioned briefly President Trump in your speech, and you said you didn't vote for him and you don't like people whose name begins with T. Or you don't vote for people whose name begins with
for
T.
For president, anyway.
For president. Don't tell Malcolm Turnbull this. Now, you also made the point that everything's always a catastrophe in relation to how a lot of people discuss American foreign policy. What about what was said to be the forthcoming catastrophe if the Trump administration moved the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to West Jerusalem? What was the story there? How did that catastrophe work out?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that Donald Trump made it to the White House was a public perception that something was seriously wrong. You know, there was no other way that a man like that could get that job, honestly. And Trump's core message to the electorate in 2016 was the emperor has no clothes. The establishment doesn't know what it's doing. They disdain you, they hate you, they demand deference and obedience from you, but they have absolutely no idea what they're doing. And I am the only one brave enough and who cares enough about you to take this on myself. And yes, they hate me for saying this. They hate you and they hate me because I am with you. And the more they howl and the more they hate in my direction, that's the more they see me as a threat because I stand with you. That's Trump's message. And it's a very effective message, obviously. He used the issue of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem in a very effective way to make this point. All right. As you, I'm sure many of you know, the U.S. Embassy for many years, like almost every embassy in the world, I think maybe every embassy in the world, was in Tel Aviv, while the State of Israel has always said that its capital is Jerusalem. Now, every state in the world is seen to have the right to determine where its capital is. When Australia announced that it was going to create a capital in Canberra, there are a lot of diplomats who didn't want to move to Canberra. And frankly, I think a number of Australians didn't want to move to Canberra. But they did because the capital of a country is where the country says its capital is. There was real heartbreak in Brazil when they announced the capital would no longer be Rio de Janeiro, but was going to be Brasilia. And believe me, there were embassies that clung by their fingertips to their properties in Rio as long as they could, but they are now all miserably, perhaps in some cases, in Brasilia. All right, but Israel says Jerusalem is our capital, and well, you know, well, you're a state, but you're a Jewish state, and anyway, And so everyone keeps the capital in Tel Aviv, keeps their embassies in Tel Aviv. Now, this has always been a bit unpopular in the U.S., and so in 1992, Bill Clinton ran against George H.W. Bush and accused him of keeping the embassy. Why don't we move the embassy to Jerusalem? And so Clinton is elected, and yet there's the embassy still in Tel Aviv. What happened? I don't know what happened. But into the Clinton presidency, Congress then passes a law declaring that the embassy must move to Jerusalem. However, in the fine print, way down, the president can sign a waiver every 6 months, say that it's not in the national interest to move the embassy, and so the embassy can stay. So Clinton then signs the waiver every 6 months. And then in 2000, when W. Bush ran against the Clinton-Gore administration, he had the revenge and satisfaction of saying, and you violating the law, you don't move the embassy to Jerusalem. What is wrong with you people? He gets elected and then 16 times in 8 years signs a waiver saying it's in the national interest for the embassy to stay in Tel Aviv. Barack Obama in 2008, running for president, goes to the AIPAC meeting and says to the American-Israel Political Action Committee, the capital of Israel is Jerusalem. Thunderous applause. He gets elected and signs the waiver 16 more times. The embassy stays in Tel Aviv. Trump says, these people all told you they were going to do it if they got elected, and none of them did. I will move the embassy. He got elected, and he starts the process to move the embassy, at which point the entire Middle East establishment, ex-diplomats, famous peacemakers, former presidents, former secretaries of state, ambassadors, academics, the entire galaxy of our glorious foreign policy establishment rises up as one to say, if you do this, this will be the greatest disaster ever seen. The Middle East will erupt in flames. The Intifada will look like a tea party in a daycare center. All right, on and on. They spoke on TV. They signed petitions. They took out advertisements in newspapers. So Trump then moves the embassy to Jerusalem, and nothing happens. All right, for Trump, this is perfection, chef's kiss. All the other politicians are liars who have nothing but contempt, who will say anything to you to get elected, but then will totally ignore your wishes. And the establishment and the experts don't know anything. And I alone am the one who will tell you this and act on it. If everything in the Trump administration had worked like this, we would be now contemplating whether we would amend the Constitution to get Trump a third term.
I'll take that. Mm-hmm. And Richard, just come back here.
I thought it was for me.
Yeah, but you said you didn't want it.
Well, now I
you
do.
You do, okay.
And you took it. Now.
Professor, could I ask you this question? A recently deceased and very, very well-known Australian Army General and Senator in our federal parliament published a book, Jim Molan I'm talking about, who makes the grimmest outline of what could happen if there was a war involving the United States and China over Taiwan. The suggestion has been made that it'll never happen, and that the alternative will be that the Chinese will use their cyber powers and a boycott by sending their ships around Taiwan so that there will be no fire, there will be no forceful effort, but the United States would be reluctant to take military action under those circumstances to prevent the CRP from becoming the governors of Taiwan.
This is one of 10,000 scenarios that scenario spinners come up with, and it's a perplexing and not utterly improbable one. But once, you know, but I think the United States would, in fact, threaten force against a blockade, assuming we have the force to carry that out. But I think it's probably worth responding by thinking about what the future of Taiwan means to Australia and Australian security, because that's what should be determining really your approach as Australians to this question. And that is, I mean, if China were to succeed in forcibly reunifying with or taking over Taiwan, let's say, what this would mean in terms of U.S. prestige and U.S. naval presence in the East Pacific would be the United States would be much less of a factor. So Australia would, on the one hand, have a much stronger and more assertive China, with much less of a U.S. protection to fall back on. That's probably not a pleasant thing for Australians to contemplate, but that's not even the worst thing I think that would happen. Because if you talk to people in Japan who were involved in this business, what they'll tell you, at least what they were telling me last fall, is that if China were to take over Taiwan, Japan would essentially lose its independence as a great power. Because if you look at where Japan's trade routes go, Japan couldn't get oil from the Middle East or trade with Europe or Southeast Asia without essentially China's permission. And China would presumably want extract some sort of a price. So Japan would shift from the West to the pro-China camp. And again, think about Australia's position, where instead of Japan being a reliable partner in trying to maintain, to balance China in the region, Japan is in the China column. And the United States is extremely remote. All right, that's what we're looking at. It is a fundamental, for Australians, it is, I would compare it to 1941, 1942 in terms of its implications for Australian security and independence. And preventing that scenario without war must be, it seems to me, the object of all of our policies. Because again, for us in the United States, a union, so to speak, of Japanese wealth and technology with China would mean that, you know, we're starting to dig bunkers in Hawaii. This is, you know, this is something the U.S. has tried to prevent for 200 years, the domination of the Asian region by one superpower. So it's an existential, and obviously for the Japanese, it's an existential threat. And South Korea would have no choice but to kind of go along with this realignment. Where does that leave Vietnam? Where does that leave Indonesia? It's obvious. So it's a small island, but it is a hinge of fate. And again, there is no doubt that a war between the United States and its allies and China over Taiwan would likely be a hideous disaster with all kinds of horrible implications, first and foremost for the people of Taiwan, but for everybody else. And if we think about what, you know, this may come as a shock to some, but wars are actually bad for efforts to leave fossil fuels behind and fight climate change. That in a war of survival like this, the Asian industrial machine, China, America, no one would be thinking about such things. And the environmental consequences of this war would be like nothing we've seen and would put, I think, an end to any real option of doing anything serious about climate for the foreseeable future. So all of those things tell us that the sensible thing to do, the only sensible thing, is to maintain a margin of military superiority in that region that makes it look to the Chinese as if they will not succeed in an invasion or an end run like this blockade scenario, and to combine that with enough signals that our resolution is evident. If we do that, we could go on the way we are for another 100 years. The Chinese, if they see that they cannot take Taiwan, will not want to talk about Taiwan. Why would you advertise? Why would you bring up a question that only demonstrates your impotence and ends in a humiliation? Just don't talk about that subject. I think we would actually, and we did, when we had military superiority there, we had a better political relationship with China than we do now. Military superiority around the Taiwan Sea, not aimed at invasion of China. None of us want to do that, right? So we're not talking about threatening China's security, but simply putting this goal out of reach. That's the way to go. Again, the fact that something this obvious and evident seems to have escaped the notion of our national security planners for 15 years really should make us think.
Question here, then I've got a question from Zoom, and there's one down the back.
Okay, I go along with your appeasement argument exactly, but if you go back to the 1930s, it was only less than two decades when the war of all wars had been fought, and the electorate, the citizens, along with the leaders, were terrified of that happening again. But we haven't had that. So where does this appeasement mentality derive from? Who began it? Is it the universities? Is it our lazy, Western, wealthy lifestyle? The march of the left through the universities? Whatever. Where does it begin?
I think a problem this big often has many causes. And I think we can point to a lot of things. One of them that I tend to highlight is that it's not, I look at least in the U.S., I look at many people in the sort of intellectual world of foreign policy. And what I notice is that whether they're on the left or on the right, they often think in very doctrinaire terms. So, if you think about the WTO and free trade, we had that argument that, of course, free trade will make China democratic, because trade liberalization, economic liberalization will lead to political liberalization. I mean, one can sort of see that as a general argument, but to bet the ranch on that being true and not watch to see whether that prediction is being carried out, fulfilled. And then on the left, I think you had, you had another set of doctrines that people believed. And I think, the root cause of this is not so much that the left is marching through the university, but that everybody is marching through the university. I actually think, this is maybe the most heretical opinion I hold, and I may get stoned for uttering it, but I actually think that if we had fewer people with PhDs making foreign policy, our foreign policy would be significantly enhanced. That spending your life in a classroom where if you study the problem, you get a good grade on the exam. And you're sort of taught to see life problems as theoretical problems. That if you do your homework and use the right methodology, you will succeed. That is so not the way the actual world works. And in past years, when we had to limp along with fewer qualified people and had to bring in people from the worlds of business and other fields of communal life, we had less dogmatic, more practical thinking, and I believe that would actually be a significant contribution.
Now, we don't have a lot of time, so we're going to be pretty brief. I've got a similar question to come from outside of Canberra, so I thought we'd better give it to you. Do you believe that woke ideas are weakening our ability to fight? Is this just another alarmist concern about young people, from young people, or is there something more insidious? In other words, is there a particular problem here with the youth or not?
Yes.
And why?
Next question.
And why would that
be? Well, look, I do think that, I teach college, and I run into a lot of students with various woke ideas, and I have to say some of my best students have been students who profoundly disagreed with me. And I'm an old-fashioned liberal. I believe in freedom of thought and opinion, et cetera. So let me preface it all with this. But I think wokeness, we can see among others, is a form of this dogmatism. That it's not simply, it's this passionate belief that if we all say the right things and think the right thoughts, the world will be good. Since 1945 and the nuclear explosions at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, humanity has lived in the shadow of total catastrophe. And we've also lived with the knowledge that as human beings, we're pretty imperfect and prone to error. And I think, this generation is haunted not just by nuclear fears, which after many years of being kind of in the background have been quite rapidly moving to the fore, but haunted by fears of climate change. Pandemics have certainly caught their attention recently. And so there's tremendous fear. And the hunger in times of fear for some kind of sure path out and this idea that somehow if the West could purify itself of all forms of race prejudice, of in post-imperialism, all of these things, that somehow then we would cleanse ourselves of the things that hold us down and allow us to sail up to what would automatically be a new and better world. It's a noble hope in a way, and a beautiful hope, but I think a false one. The human condition will not so easily be remedied.
We've got two questions out the back and then one up here.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for the talk. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think in a short amount of time, you've been able to acknowledge the failures of the U.S., that there's been a generational failure. I just want to ask you this question, a very simple question. I'm glad you mentioned the balance of power as lacking in U.S. foreign policy. My question is, what would the balance of power look like for America if they just let China, Iran, and Russia be? Just let them be communists in their own rights. How are these three creating a dent in the supposedly peaceful life of the rest of the world? Is America...
Okay, we got it.
So I think I've got the question. It's good, you know. Well, let's just take the question of Iran. I mean, I could answer all of them, but we're running out of time. And actually, of those three countries, Iran is the one that's had the most success in affecting its neighbors. So Iran today is more or less in charge of Iraq. It's the greatest power in Syria. It's dominant in Lebanon, and it's a major force in Yemen. Everywhere Iranian power has gone, you see war. You see misery, you see horror on a great scale, and you see threats of worse violence to come. There, you know, there is no such thing as a Pax Iranica for the Middle East. It's a recipe for perpetual war and unrest. We can see the same thing in Ukraine, where Putin's vision for what Russia should be, right, involves the destruction of another country that doesn't want to be destroyed. And Ukraine is not the only one on his list. And again, in China, step one is to take over Taiwan, a place that doesn't want it. So in that sense, these countries, their agenda is destructive. Even though, you know, I'm not going to say that they are destructive, evil people necessarily, but it's just that their vision of what they want intersects with reality in a way that brings death and destruction to innocent standers-by. And the rest of us would then live in a world that was profoundly changed and threatened by this.
Question down the back.
I'd just like to ask what you think the American objective should be vis-a-vis Ukraine.
Yeah, this is, you know, I mean, I think we would like to see the war end as quickly as possible on the most favorable possible terms for Ukraine, right? What that means in practice is hard to say, because again, war is not some sort of academic theory where I have a desired end state and then move to get it. The Ukrainian war, we've already seen the conventional wisdom on this war flip over and over. The first few days, Russia has won. The first couple of months, Russia has lost, and Western sanctions are so crippling, Putin is going to fall, and like, will Russia itself collapse as a state? Then Russia regroups and long war of attrition. Then Ukraine fights back, and now again, maybe Russia moving to long war of attrition. I suspect there will be more changes on the battlefield and therefore more changes in the conventional wisdom. That's the nature of war. So you can't really project what your desired, you know, end state, because the God of battles is going to determine what happens in Ukraine. Now, you know, I believe that we need to continue to coordinate with our allies to supply Ukraine, because, you know, in the moment that we're in, a Russian victory there, a clear-cut Russian victory, would be devastating. And so we need to work on that. Again, the important thing maybe to think about for the future is there was a failure of deterrence here. How much better would we have been off? How much better off would we have been had the Biden administration basically been able to deter Putin from launching the war? That's what our goal should be. Now, obviously, you can't go back in a time machine and do that in Ukraine, but we need to restore and maintain deterrence so that these horrible, no good solution crises aren't happening like this. And so I'm looking for a solution to the war in Ukraine ultimately that strengthens deterrence and strengthens the barriers to more attacks. So that's going to have to be something very different from what happened in 2014.
Okay, here, a quick question, a quick response.
Yeah, just taking one item. US doesn't have a patent on incompetence, fortunately. And
yes,
perhaps the first element of incompetence would be an over-evaluation of the Russian military threat. Secondly, on the Russian side, the complete failure to understand that you can't link a 21st century huge technological army with an economy the size of Australia and New Zealand. I could go on also with Iran. Go on with Iran and China. The levels of incompetence are by no means unique. I suggest that a number of them, in many cases, are more on the other side.
Okay. I think it's true. Fortunately, we're not the only people that make mistakes. And you definitely want to give your opponents all the opportunities possible to make mistakes. Putin, I think, has made a mistake in invading Ukraine. But, you know, Putin has been, for the last 20 years on the whole, a better geopolitical tactician than his opponents in the West. You know, he's not necessarily a great strategist because his goals are probably impossible. A little bit, I'm born in South Carolina. I think sometimes of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, who was, in a sense, a much better general than most of his Northern opponents because he knew if he wasn't brilliant, he would lose, that the natural weight of cause and effect was going to grind the Confederacy down. So he had to dare things that other people wouldn't dare, and he won victories that others couldn't have won. And, you know, Putin has that quality of being brilliantly inventive because he knows actually that the odds are against him. But I think this makes him dangerous. And to sort of smugly tell ourselves, well, we don't have to worry because in the long arc of history, you know, Russia is toast or whatever. No, I think, you know, we've actually got to realize that we are in a proxy war with a man who is skilled and dangerous and at the end of the day still has a lot of resources that he hasn't put into the battle. In the past, one of the reasons the West always gave for why it wouldn't intervene in Ukraine against Russia, and that was the conventional wisdom until this war started, was escalation dominance, that fundamentally Putin cares more about Ukraine than the rest of us and therefore will do more to get it than we're willing to do to keep it. Therefore, we should just avoid all the crisis and anxiety and kind of preemptively give up. And it just turned out that when it came right down to it, we couldn't do it. So, but that does not take away the possible problem of escalation dominance here.
Just very briefly and a quick response. Just tell us a bit about your book on United States foreign policy and the Jewish community in Israel. I mean, to what extent is the existence of Israel dependent on the United States?
Yeah, this is something many people sort of have this idea in their heads that Israel is kind of an American sock puppet or a product of American power. That otherwise, how could you explain how the Jews could have, that tiny number of Jews on a land with no resources, et cetera, could have established a state that then beat so many powerful armies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, the United States, the world's greatest power, is backing it up. And by the way, therefore, if you could somehow separate the United States and Israel, Israel would have no future, would really have no choice but to gracefully collapse. And so every time an American college votes a BDS resolution, we're one more step toward, you know, the end of Israel. But you actually look at the history, at least when I did, this is what I found. First of all, the United States had very, very little to do with the creation of an independent Israel. President Truman, right up until the moment of Israel's independence, was begging the Israelis not to declare independence, to extend a UN trusteeship in order to prevent a war. And the U.S. had put an arms embargo on the Middle East, which actually favored the Arabs, because the Jews had no weapons and had no way of getting them, but the Arabs were being supplied by the British. And actually what happened is that Stalin, who was hoping both to break the hoping that he could break the British Empire and perhaps that Israel would be a very left-leaning country, Stalin provided arms. He allowed the Czechs to sell arms to the Russians that were made in the Skoda arms factory, and originally for the Nazis. And some of these weapons still had swastikas on them. And the money from that gave the communists the resources to cement their control over Czechoslovakia. The Czechs famously wanted to be part of the Marshall Plan. The response from Moscow was, these arms are your Marshall Plan, so shut up. So that, you know, far from being something that America did, it was actually something done to spite and disrupt the American order after World War II. In the same way, the French the Americans opposed the Israeli nuclear bomb right up to the end. It was the French who provided the technology. The Americans consistently tried to stop the Israeli nuclear program. America actually only, and in the 1950s, America's goal was an alliance with Nasser, not an alliance with Israel. And they're perfectly willing, as Eisenhower showed at the Suez Crisis in 1956, to dump Israel in order to try to reach out to Nasser. It's only after the Six-Day War, which the Israelis won with French arms, by the way, not American arms, when Israel has established itself as a regional superpower, and after 69, when the Americans believe it has achieved nuclear weapons, that the United States begins to treat Israel in a different way. Israel did not become great because it had an American alliance. It gained an American alliance because it had become great. And there's no disputing this history. If you go into the records, this is all sort of plain and evident, but that the public imagination of so many people in so many places is riveted to this completely unsustainable historical view is evidence of the powerful sort of cultural and mythic forces that warp perceptions of so many people in so many places about this. Sometimes it seems to me there are some subjects that people just can't think rationally about. Money, children, sex, power, and Jews. And this, to me, demonstrates the truth of that saying.
Well, there are a lot of people here tonight. We're right on time. So I just want to say thanks for a terrific performance tonight. Well done. Hope to see you back here in Australia sometime in the future.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.